Good afternoon. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Lynn Wendling, bringing you the February issue of Entertainment Weekly magazine for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The cover story, Bond Ambition. For his last mission as 007, Daniel Craig squares off against Rami Malek in this article by Clark Colas. Additionally, we may hit The Hunger Games. There's an exclusive excerpt from the new prequel. And if we have time, what to watch this winter. The scoop on 63 shows, including Star Trek Picard. So first we go to our cover story. Daniel Craig's final James Bond film, No Time to Die, which comes out April 10th, features explosive mayhem and violent physical injury. Creating it required the same. In this article entitled Unbreakable Bond by Clark Colas. Daniel Craig is mad as hell. The actor, dashing in a tuxedo, is shooting an intricately choreographed action sequence for his fifth James Bond movie, the Cary Joji Fukunaga-directed No Time to Die at Britain's famed Pinewood Studios. His current set piece takes place at a hotel in Havana, where the MI6 agent and Paloma, played by Ana de Armas, a CIA agent, are battling members of the secret and sinister organization Spectre. On this October afternoon, Craig must catch a gun flung into the air by an injured Spectre henchman, embrace the also-armed de Armas, pretend to shoot the gun, balletically circle around with his co-star, fake fire the gun again, and finally disengage from the actress so their characters can find shelter behind a pair of pillars. To an onlooker, all of this looks spectacularly difficult, but it is clear that the trickiest part for Craig is actually catching the weapon. The actor finally manages to snatch the gun out of the air, but then he fumbles it, ruining the take. The Brit's famous face crumbles into an expression of self-disgust and hot rage as he walks out of shot. I beat myself up about these things too much, Craig, 51, says a couple of months later in New York on the day of a ZW cover shoot. And actually, the way to get it right is to relax. Once I relaxed, it worked a treat. James Bond movies are always huge and testing endeavors. Mega-budget stunt-filled productions that routinely shoot in a variety of exotic locales and must compete with both other actioneers and, for fans, the franchise's previous entries. But this 25th installment in the series, which Craig swears will be his last, has been particularly short on opportunities to relax for its creatives. Why all the stress? The project began with a completely different director and writer, while its star required surgery after being badly injured on set. This is also the first Bond film to be released since the advent of the hashtag MeToo era, leaving author Ian Fleming's womanizing and far from always PC characters open to criticism that he is out of step with the times. When EW suggests to Fukunaga that joining the project must have been like jumping on a moving train and then immediately attempting to drive it, the filmmaker counters with an even more perilous scenario. It would be like jumping on the moving wheels of the train before the chassis was even there, he says, and you're building the engine as it is barreling toward the point of no return. There was a time when the biggest obstacle to Daniel Craig successfully completing his fifth James Bond movie was Daniel Craig. Shortly before the release of 2015's Spectre, he told Time Out London that if I did another Bond movie, it would only be for the money. Assuming Craig isn't just appearing in No Time to Die for the cash, which seems unlikely given the Craig household also benefits from the income of his movie star wife, Rachel Weisz, what changed his mind? I finished that movie with a broken leg, says the actor, who underwent arthroscopic surgery after injuring his knee shooting a fight scene with Spectre co-star Dave Bautista. I had to question myself, was I physically capable of doing another one, or did I want to do another one? Because that phone call to your wife saying, I've broken my leg, is not pleasant. Eventually, Craig decided that he was up to the physical challenge of another Bond, with encouragement from the franchise's longtime producer, Barbara Broccoli. He felt at the end of the last movie, he'd kind of done it, she explains. I said to him, I don't think you have. I think there's still more of the story of your Bond to tell. Fortunately, he came around to agree with that. On May 25th, 2018, Broccoli and producer Michael G. Wilson announced that Craig would be returning to the series with Danny Boyle directing and a screenplay by John Hodge, who had previously collaborated with Boyle on several movies, including Trainspotting. Boyle seemed a sound choice given his commercial successes and experience overseeing the opening ceremonies of the 2012 London Olympics, which included a taped segment featuring Craig's Bond in the real-life Queen Elizabeth II. But that August, Craig, Broccoli, and Wilson announced that Boyle had departed the project because of creative differences. According to a report in The Sun, Boyle wasn't keen on Broccoli and Craig's idea that the actor's version of Bond be killed off, although a subsequent rumor suggested it was the director who wanted to put Craig's version of 007 in the ground. It was not about anything specific, says Broccoli. The movie he wanted to make and the movie we wanted to make were not the same movie. Craig is similarly diplomatic. I'm a huge fan of Danny, and I'd love to work with him. It didn't work out. It happens all the time in movies. It's just in a Bond movie, it becomes this huge event that gets blown up. Boyle did not respond to EW's request for comment, but has said what we were doing was good, but it was obviously not what they wanted. Broccoli admits that she and Wilson considered shutting down the production entirely following Boyle's departure. Instead, they met with Fukunaga, whose credits include 2018's Beast of No Nation and HBO's True Detective, and who had been one of the filmmakers the producers considered before hiring Boyle. Carey wasn't available originally, says Broccoli, but he became available. He was very excited to join us, and we kept going. Fukunaga worked on a new screenplay in collaboration with veteran Bond screenwriters Neil Purvis and Robert Wade, as well as Scott Z. Burns, who did the Bourne Ultimatum. In spring 2019, Fleabag creator star Phoebe Waller-Bridge also contributed to the script on Craig's recommendation. The actor admired her writing on Killing Eve. She's the best effing writer around, he says. Craig also shut down rumors that Waller-Bridge was simply hired to flesh out the movie's female roles, telling a reporter from the Sunday Times, that was effing ridiculous. Rami Malek, who plays the film's villain, Safin, confirms Waller-Bridge had considerable input on his character. She had quite an impact on what I was doing, says the Bohemian Rhapsody star, 38. I'd have long phone conversations with her, giving her context as to what we were essentially looking for in the scenes, and she would turn things over incredibly quickly. We know her as a very witty and funny writer, but she's got a knack for drama and tension as well. In an interview with the BBC last November, Waller-Bridge said she was not hired on to address Bond's misogynistic attitudes because the producers were already doing that themselves. Broccoli insists Craig Spy is a good fit for the age of hashtag Me Too. He's evolved, like men are evolving, one hopes, says the producer. Daniels brought a lot of humanity into the role and into his relationships in the film. He's got vulnerabilities. He's much more 21st century. Bond will also have a genuine peer this time around in the form of a female 00 agent named Nomi, played by Lashana Lynch, who was in Captain Marvel. "She is a fierce, opinionated working woman," says Lynch, 32, of her character. In July of last year, the blood pressure of traditional Bond fans rocketed when the Daily Mail reported that Lynch's character would in fact replace Bond as 007. The, quote, news, unquote, became a massive story to both the delight and annoyance of Broccoli. "People write these theories without knowing," she says, "but we're always happy that people are interested in what's happening in our world." De Armas, who also co-starred with Craig in Knives Out, confirms that her character, Paloma, is no damsel in distress either. "She's a strong woman, for sure," says the actress, 31. The 25th Bond movie was initially scheduled to come out in fall 2019, but the switch in directors prompted the producers to push the release date to February 2020 and then to April. With the script unfinished and the start of production looming, Fukunaga was under the gun. Still, the director had no intention of rushing things. "Gary is more of a scriptwriter than Danny and super interested in making sure every single word was crafted and correct," says production designer Mark Tilsdesley, who was originally hired by Bowl. "That took a lot longer than we imagined," says Fukunaga. "Haste makes waste. There's a lot of people around us who are pressuring us to go fast, but we've got to get it done right." The revamped plot reintroduces the British spy sometime after he left the espionage world behind at the end of Spectre to begin a new life with Léa Seydoux's French psychologist Madeleine Swann. In No Time to Die, Bond is retired and living in Jamaica, but, as Broccoli hints, no longer swanning around with his one-time paramour. "He decided to go off with her and try to have a normal life," says the producer, which, of course, we completely blow a hole through at the beginning of this one. He starts off on a romantic journey with Madeleine and then believes that he's been betrayed by her, adds Seydoux, 35. S blank, blank, blank happens. Everything falls apart. Bond is lured back into the spy game by his old CIA pal, Felix Leiter, played by Jeffrey Wright, who asks him for help rescuing a kidnapped scientist, David Dencik, from top of the lake. This leads Bond to Cuba and onto the trail of Malik's mysterious Safin. "He's really a mean old thing," says Broccoli of the villain. In the movie's trailer, Safin also appears to have facial scarring. Let's just say that there are some immense challenges he has faced in his life, says Malik. In addition to Bond, Swan, and Leiter, other returning characters include Ralph Fiennes' M, Naomi Harris's Moneypenny, Ben Whishaw's Q, Rory Kinnear's Tanner, and Christopher Waltz's Spectre Chief Ernest Blofeld, whose life Bond spared at the end of the last installment. Blofeld is in Belmarsh Prison, says Broccoli, but he's actually communicating to the Spectre agents. Shooting on No Time to Die finally began at the end of April 2019 in Jamaica. The island has a particular resonance for the 007 franchise. It was here that Bond author Ian Fleming started writing the novels about the super spy at his estate, Goldeneye, and portions of both Dr. No and Live and Let Die were filmed on the island. But Fukunaga's train threatened to go off the rails when Craig was hurt while shooting a scene. "I was running down a floating dock, and it was wet, and I slipped, and I fell over, and my ankle exploded," says Craig. "Unfortunately, I've been in the same situation before, and I know the feeling of a rupturing tendon. I was like, oh, F blank, blank, blank." Craig's injury required both surgery and a restructuring of the shooting schedule so the actor could convalesce. "I've got a great surgeon in London who said, have this operation and you'll be ready to run in 10 weeks. You know, 10 weeks is sometimes the length of a movie shoot. not on a Bond movie. It's just a small part of it. So I was like, okay, let's do it. I was back at work in 2 weeks, and in 10 weeks, I was throwing myself around like an idiot again. In New York last December, almost 2 months after No Time to Die wrapped, Barbara Broccoli strikes a much more relaxed figure than the wild-haired producer E.W. met at Pinewood. Of course, soon she and Wilson will have to start seriously considering who will replace Craig as James Bond. For now, the producer is happy to put off the task. We still have so much to do to finish this film, to get it right, so we're really focusing on that, she says. I'm in denial, to be honest, about Daniel. I can't really confront that right now. And then we have a little sidebar. The five best Bond films ranked. Beginning Bond, want to fake your way through a Bond conversation? Watch these titles and become an instant whiz in this piece by Darren Franchuk. First, Casino Royale, 2006. Parker in Madagascar. Seduction in the Bahamasi Poker in Montenegro. Daniel Craig's debut remains the globe-trotting standard. And as witty, mysterious Vesper Lynn, Eva Green steals the movie and Bond's heart. The second, Goldfinger, 1964. Modern eyes aren't kind to Sean Connery's regressive antics, but this snazzy cold water caper balances horny glam camp with a sly sense of humor. Witness the death laser slowly approaching Bond's private parts. Number three, For Your Eyes Only, 1981. Roger Moore always looks so splendidly relaxed, which serves him especially well in this leisure getaway spy dream. Bond skis, scubas, and even mountain climbs to a lush remote monastery for the genuinely stunning climax. Number four, The Living Daylights, 1987. The time has come to reassess Timothy Dalton, whose dashing 007 romances, Miriam Diabo's sniper cellist in this classically subdued thriller. Dalton's also great in the admittedly ludicrous Drug Lord and Sharks Riot, License to Kill. And then number five, Die Another Day, 2002. And the time has come to rediscover the too much cheekiness of Pierce Brosnan's finale, where Bond drives an invisible car through an ice palace to flee a sun laser. Give Halle Berry's serene super spy Jinx the spinoff she deserved. One more little sidebar, The Italian Job. In No Time to Die, James Bond will remind audiences he also has a license to drive. During a car chase sequence filmed in the ancient city of Matera, Italy. This piece was written by Clark Colas also. One of No Time to Die's major action sequences features James Bond pursued by a multitude of cars and motorcycles as he flies behind the wheel of a newly souped-up version of the super spy's iconic 60s-era Aston Martin DB5. According to longtime Bond special effects and action vehicles supervisor Chris Corbould, it's the original car with a few updates, including miniguns rather than Brownings and LED screens rather than revolving license plates. While Daniel Craig is happy to admit that stunt drivers were usually behind the Aston Martin's wheel, there are some shots that will feature his own vehicular skills. I managed to actually do some driving in Matera, the Knives Out actor says. They actually trusted me with it. I did some donuts. Next up, our winter TV preview. Familiar faces return, such as Patrick Stewart and Edie Falco. Old friends get animated, such as Amy Poehler and Star Wars clones. And new binge buddies are waiting, as Zoe Kravitz making extraordinary playlist on High Fidelity, Jane Levy starring on Zoe's extraordinary playlist. Snuggle up, we've got your February covered. First up, Star Trek Picard. network is CBS All Access. The date started January 23rd. It's streaming. The genre is a new drama. This is no longer your house, Jean-Luc, roars a Starfleet admiral early in the first season of the new Star Trek series. The typically unflappable former USS Enterprise captain, played by Patrick Stewart, looks stunned by this dressing down, which includes the first F-bomb ever uttered around the beloved character. It's a shocking moment, not just for the language, or even because a Starfleet leader is berating such a revered character, but because their debate, which concerns Starfleet's role in the tragic destruction of the planet Romulus, nudges the viewer toward an unsettling thought. Picard, the absolute moral authority during seven seasons of Star Trek The Next Generation, might actually be wrong. These gray edges perhaps best distinguish this show from its predecessor, and lured Stewart to return to an iconic role he was convinced he had left behind. Patrick was very clear early on that he did not want to present a black and white world, but one where Starfleet was forced to make a very complicated decision. Executive producer Alex Kurtzman says, "There's definitely going to be disagreements and difficult decisions. This really is the first truly adult drama in the world of Star Trek. We took all the classic tropes and challenged them." Star Trek Picard picks up with the retired admiral at his vineyard in France, haunted by events surrounding the botched evacuation of Romulus years earlier, and an event depicted in J.J. Abrams' 2009 Star Trek film, which Kurtzman co-wrote. A mysterious young woman, Daja, played by Issa Briones, arrives begging for help. Her plea leads Picard to hire a ship and crew for a mysterious renegade journey that forces him to re-examine his past, including time as a prisoner of the sinister Borg Collective. Stewart says he first met with Kurtzman and fellow executive producer Akiva Goldsman to politely decline their offer to reprise his character. "I just didn't want to do it," Stewart says. "I'm very proud of the work we did on Next Generation, most of our work, but I felt I had said and done everything I could about Jean-Luc Picard and didn't see any point." Yet the 79-year-old actor was just intrigued enough to request 4 pages of additional information. Kurtzman and Goldsman sent him 34. That's when he understood we were dedicated to exploring a new chapter in a way that hadn't been done before, Kurtzman says. So we have Star Trek in prime time. From Kirk to Bunham, a history of boldly gone. So this is a little sidebar. Star Trek 1966 to 1969. Then The Next Generation was 1967 to 1994. Deep Space Nine, 1993 to 1999. Voyager was 1995 through 2001. Enterprise was 2001 through 2005. And then Discovery, 2017 to the present. Stewart made it clear that he wanted to take a cue from Logan, the R-rated 2017 X-Men film that took his Professor X and Hugh Jackman's Wolverine into a very different, more mature direction, and I wanted it to reflect how our world has changed, Stewart adds. Star Trek always references the present day to tell stories about the future. Another discussion involved reenlisting TNG crew members, which concerned Stewart. While the actor loved reuniting with old friends, he didn't want to fill the series with fan service. A rule emerged that any legacy characters are only going to show up because the story cannot be told without them, Kurtzman says. The first season includes Data, played by Brent Spiner, Still dead from his Star Trek nemesis heroics as the story opens, former Commander Will Riker, played by Jonathan Frakes, who also directed two episodes, and Deanna Troi, played by Marina Sirtis, now cohabitating on a remote planet, and Voyager fan favorite Seven of Nines, played by Jeri Ryan, the Borg drone turned Starfleet officer who is far more human acting, the reason makes sense, Ryan assures, yet is now part of a vigilante group. She's so different and has been through so much. She's in a very dark place when we meet her, Ryan teases. And then there are Stewart's new co-stars, among them a disillusioned Starfleet officer turned freelance pilot, Santiago Cabrera, another ex-Starfleet officer struggling with substance abuse, Michelle Hurd, and that young woman played by newcomer Briones, who had the out-of-this-world experience of going from performing in musical theater to taking center stage on this major TV series. My first scene was right in the thick of it. Okay, you're screaming at Patrick Stewart. Go, she recalls. Yet for all the changes, some things remain. The world is identifiably Star Trek, with transporters and warp speed and Romulans. Picard's moral compass still points in the right direction, even if he's not infallible. And there's that moment he enters the bridge. Picard glances at the captain's chair, but doesn't take it. Yet he can't help but give a one-word order with a familiar wave of his hand, gesturing towards the great unknown. Engage. This piece was written by James Hibbert. And then we have For Life. It's on ABC. It starts on February 11th at 10 p.m. The genre, it's a new drama. An inmate is in the fight of his life on this legal drama inspired by a true story. For Life follows prisoner-turned-lawyer Aaron Wallace, played by Nicholas Pinnock, as he combats his wrongful conviction and litigates cases for his fellow inmates, all while behind bars. It's tackling the disparity of privilege between those who have money and power and those who don't, says showrunner Hank Steinberg, promising this isn't just an eat-your-vegetables show. It's entertaining, and it's tense, and it's suspenseful. You're with Aaron on this incredible, wild, and difficult ride. And this piece was written by Chancellor Agard. And then we have Katie Keene. It's on the CW. It debuted February 6th at 8 p.m. It's a new genre also. Katie Keene is stepping out of the noir shadows of Riverdale and into the spotlight, says co-creator Michael Grassi. We're entering worlds like fashion, music, Broadway, drag. It's a show about dreamers. The Archieverse trades pulp and horror for optimism and romance, following fashion designer Katie, or Kathy, played by Lucy Hale, singer Josie, played by Ashley Murray, and pals as they come of age in the Big Apple. We call it the New York of the imagination, notes co-creator Roberto Aguiar Sacasa, citing its retro vibes. So less pizza rat, more breakfast at Tiffany's. And this piece was written by Maureen Lee Lenker. Tommy. Four-time Emmy winner Edie Falco from Nurse Jackie and The Sopranos headlines her first broadcast TV series on Tommy, a drama from Bull co-creator Paul Attanasio about a high-ranking New York City cop who becomes L.A.'s first female police chief. It's on CBS. It debuted yesterday, February 6th, at 10 p.m. The genre is a new drama. And it's a little interview here. You look pretty badass in this role. Tommy, it's just the uniform, man. Anybody would. It's pretty fancy. It's also very heavy. I'm carrying a lot of artillery, so it took some getting used to. EW, why did you want to play a female police chief on a CBS procedural? Edie, the sexism seems so foreign to her because it's not the world she grew up in. She grew up with cops, and I don't know that she ever really thought of herself as anything other than that. A cop is a cop. EW. As a divorced lesbian, does she face any homophobia in the police ranks? ED. There's less of that, actually, than sexism. It's not an advertised part of who she is, which I think is about time that we can just have a show where a woman happens to be gay, and it's not necessarily about breaking barriers or standing on a soapbox. EW. What else do we learn about Tommy? ED. She wasn't much of a mother to her adult daughter, Bulls Olivia Lucy Phillip, because being a cop was more important. Finally, EW. It's only a matter of time before somebody confuses you for the real thing, right? ED. The prop people who put all that stuff on you are very careful. If we're outside, they take all that stuff off of you before you're allowed to leave set, because yes, it happens. And it's not necessarily a good thing. This piece was reported by Lynette Wright. You're tuned in to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and we are recording the February issue of Entertainment Weekly magazine. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. We're continuing on what to watch this winter. The scoop on 63 shows. Next up, Mythic Quest, Raven's Banquet. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia star Rob McElhenney, 42, trades swizzle sticks for joysticks as he switched gears to play the visionary boss at a gaming company on his new Apple TV workplace comedy. It's on Apple TV. It starts today, February 7th. It's a streaming, and it's a new comedy. And here's a little question and answer from EW. EW, how would you describe Mythic Quest, Raven's Banquet? Rob, on the surface, it's a show that takes place in a video game company. It's the top game in the world, Mythic Quest. My character is the creative director of the game. He is, from his words, the visionary behind it. And then he slowly put together a team that could actually execute his vision. Although the show has somewhat to do with the video game industry, it's more specifically about the people that want to bring you this game. EW. And this came about when you got a phone call from Ubisoft, the company behind Assassin's Creed and Just Dance. Rob, they liked the approach. They likely approached me because they like Sunny, and they said, "Hey, we're interested in doing a show about the video game industry." I didn't know much about video games, so I wasn't really that interested. They said, "Why don't you just come meet some of the people that make these games?" Within an hour of talking to them, I knew that we had something really interesting. Sunny is about these people who are stuck together because of their abject failure. So we thought, well, it might be interesting to do the complete opposite, where people are stuck together at Mythic Quest not because of their failure, but because of their success. EW, what are some of the topics that you're excited to explore? Rob, I truly believe that in terms of watching a television series, nobody cares about video games in the way that nobody cares about the success or failure of a bar. Ultimately, the audience is there to see the characters and how they're all relating to one another and how they're managing through their daily grind. It just so happens that this show takes place in the video game industry, but I really feel like it could be anywhere, especially in a place where the stakes are very high. And you have incredibly talented and driven people that are stuck together. Those stories really interested us. And the final question, why was this the right time for you to do this? Rob, after 14 years, we've got Sunny production down to about 5.5 months out of the year. So I realized that I have 7 or 8 months and I'm just sort of free. Sunny is always going to be my baby. But I realized, oh wow, I can put Sunny behind me for those 8 months and put everything I can into making something new. This piece was reported by Patrick Gomez. And then we have Star Wars, The Clone Wars. Network is Disney. It comes out February 21st, streaming. The genre, recurring animated drama. Like a force ghost, Star Wars' inventive animated series is rising from the dead for a swan song season. After an untimely cancellation and a short Netflix continuation, Star Wars The Clone Wars returns for a seventh and final season, bringing closure to favorites like Ahsoka Tano, played by Ashley Eckstein, and Captain Rex, played by Dee Bradley Baker. I tried to do things that honored what we had been doing on this series when I was working with George Lucas, says executive producer and supervising director Dave Filoni. At the same time, I knew this had to have a sense of completion. This piece was recorded by Devin Doggan. Then we have Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist. It's on NBC, debuts February 18th. It's a time slot premiere. The time is 9 p.m., the genre, new musical drama. In the months before showrunner Austin Winsberg's father passed away from progressive supranuclear palsy, called PSP, a rare neurological disease, he couldn't talk. With distance, says Winsberg, I started thinking, what if my dad saw the world when he was dying through big musical numbers? It felt joyous rather than sad. So when Zoe, played by Jane Levy, suddenly hears people's thoughts in song, they include those of her father, played by Peter Gallagher, who suffers from PSP. We have scenes that communicate just through dance and song, Levy says. Endorphins from music are real. This piece was recorded by Sydney Buxbaum. Then we have High Fidelity. It's on Hulu, debuting February 14th, streaming. It's a new comedy. Nick Hornby's 1995 book/pop music love letter, already adapted into a hit John Cusack film and a Broadway musical, begets a new iteration. This one, a TV take starring Zoe Kravitz as the lovelorn top five list-making record store owner, Rob. Anytime we pitched it, people were like, yes, oh my God, that makes so much sense, says executive producer Sarah Kuserka of Gender Flipping the Character. To have this kind of a woman, not to mention a woman of color, that we don't see very often on screen, felt like we got to reimagine and refresh the idea in a whole new way. Sarah Rodman recorded this piece. And then Dan Snyerson recorded this next one called Duncanville. It's on the Fox Network, debuts February 16th at 8:30 p.m. It's a new animated comedy. Welcome to Duncanville, population one average awkward teen. The series follows Duncan, played by Amy Poehler, as he deals with an intense mom, played by Poehler, his tragically needy dad, played by Ty Burrell, and quirky friends Zach Cherry, Yazir Lester. We wanted to sit nicely between The Simpsons and Bob's Burgers, but to have more of the teenage world, says Mike Scully, who created the show with his wife Julie and Poehler. Plus, Duncan's crush on cool girl Mia, played by Rashida Jones, comes value-added, quips Scully. It answers all the requests we used to get on Parks and Rec about when are Anne and Leslie going to hook up. Outlander, on the Starz Network. It debuted February 6th at 8 p.m. It's a returning drama. Does someone have a God complex? In an upcoming episode of Outlander, a determined Claire, played by Catriona Balfi, tries to create penicillin so she can stave off a potential medical disaster on Fraser's Ridge. But her daughter, come fellow time traveler Brianna, played by Sophie Skelton, worries that her surgeon mother is trying to upend the 18th century with a 20th century drug. Pretending to be someone else and writing lists that go against the accepted wisdom of the day is one thing, Brianna says to Claire. This, it's dangerous. What if it messes with some cosmic balance or breaks some rule of space and time? We're long past that, Bonnie laughs. In fact, her beau Roger, played by Richard Rankin, is eager to abandon their pioneer life in North Carolina this season and resume a thoroughly modern life with Bree. As a couple, they had an understanding, explains executive producer Matthew B. Roberts, of the duo's decision last season to time travel to 18th century Scotland. But her feelings are starting to change. Her support system is here, so her take is, aren't we home? In so many ways, Outlander is a very different show from the lush romance that was first introduced to audiences in 2014. Highly erotic sex scenes in Scottish castles have largely been replaced with Claire and Jamie, played by Sam Hugan, hacking out a new destination for expats in North Carolina. So when Star CEO Jeffrey Hirsch referred to Hugan as eye candy last summer, the stands became apocalyptic that their Highlander hero, who now has gray hair and wears spectacles, was still being reduced to a piece of meat. The comment didn't do him great justice to how he has developed as an actor, says Hirsch, but he didn't mind getting fans' knickers in a twist. You want a fan base that is passionate, whether it is good, bad, or ugly. They are talking about Outlander all the time. This piece was reported by Lynette Briarpatch. After building a resume full of charming or badass supporting film performances and serving as the connective tissue for Netflix's Marvel TV universe, Rosario Dawson assumes the lead in USA's adaptation of Ross Thomas's novel. She stars as Allegra Dill, a political fixer who returns to her quirky hometown to solve the mystery of her cop sister. The network is USA, debuted February 6th at 10 p.m. It's a new drama. It's an interview. EW, what intrigued you about this show? I've never done anything like this. So often I've played the girlfriend or some storyline device kind of character and not that main protagonist in this way. It was really good for me and my spirit to know that I could take advantage of an opportunity like this and rise to the occasion. EW, did you read Ross Thomas's book? I did not. I'm so impressionable and would have adapted the male characteristics into a woman. I wanted to do it through the lens of creator Andy Greenwald because it was his idea to make the character female. EW, how would you describe Allegra in the world of Briarpatch? It's a very particular type of storytelling, and there's a particular cadence. It feels like that gumshoe-ish, noirish kind of world when we did the first screening. It was really exciting to see people get that. Like, oh, she comes off like a Humphrey Bogart character. Finally, EW, the first season is built on the mystery of the case, so what should viewers expect from the ending? Rosario, I'd be very surprised if anyone who hasn't read the book is able to figure out where it's going. I didn't want to know how it ended, but during filming, I remember Andy started talking to co-star J.R. Ferguson about it, so I walked away. And then I came back and Jay goes, wow, I'm still thinking about the ending. He was like teary, and I was like, what the F is the ending? She laughs. It definitely hits some nerves. This piece was recorded by Derek Lawrence. Then we have Better Call Saul. The network is AMC. The date it debuts is February 23rd at 10 p.m. It's a returning drama. Jimmy McGill is a new man, quite literally. The troubled lawyer, Bob Odenkirk, faked his way into reinstatement and is now set to practice as Saul Goodman to the disbelief of confidant Kim Wexler, played by Rhee Seehorn. It is the tensest, testifies Seehorn, of season 5. It's the funniest. It's the most magic. It's the most complex. Deep, deep, deep character explorations, including for Kim as she reassesses Jimmy. What part of this ride am I in for, and what part am I not? Who is the real you, and who is the real me? Asked Sehorn. It was a lot to unpack, and the writers did not shy away from any of this, reported by Dan Snyerson. Then we have Lock and Key on Netflix. It debuts tonight, February 7th, streaming. It's a new drama. The journey of Lock and Key, from comic book by Joe Hill and Gabriel Rodriguez to Netflix show, has been long and winding. The setup: the Locke family moves cross-country after their father's murder, only to discover that their ancestral New England home is full of magical keys. One can open a person's head, allowing them to revisit memories or even remove certain personality traits. It's not a traditional haunted house show, says showrunner Carlton Cuse, who did Lost. I remember thinking when I was reading the comics, this is not something we have seen before. This really motivated me to get this to the screen, as reported to Christian Holub. And then Cherish the Day on the OWN network. It debuts on the 11th and 12th of February at 10 p.m. It's a new drama. Executive producer Ava DuVernay brings us an anthology that examines the inner workings of a relationship over the course of 5 years, starring Josiah Rocamoore, who did The Mindy Project, and Alano Miller, who did Underground. The series, 8 episodes, each track a single day. It's such a roller coaster, says Rocamoore. Since it takes place over a 24-hour period, we get into the details, from the extraordinary to the mundane. The series also co-stars legend Cicely Tyson, with whom Rocamoore was thrilled to work. She was brilliant and amazing and full of cool stories, as recorded by Sarah Rodman. And then Gentrified on the Netflix network, debuting on the 21st of February. It's a streaming. It's a new dramedy. 3 Latinx couples, played by Carrie Martin, Carlos Santos, and J.J. Soria, seek out the American dream in the ever-changing Boyle Heights neighborhood of Los Angeles. It's a very relatable story about family and about finding identity in America today, says executive producer America Ferrara, who was in Superstory and Ugly Betty. At the heart of it, there's the very real and very relevant circumstances of gentrification and how neighborhoods are changing and at what cost, people's cultures and way of life shifting and changing, and how we all play a part in that, as recorded by Rosie Cordero. Homeland Network Showtime. It comes out on February 9th at 9 p.m., and it's a returning drama. Homeland is back after a 2-year hiatus to chronicle Carrie Mathison's toughest assignment yet, a return to Afghanistan as the U.S. attempts to end its longest-running war. The 8th and final season opens with the tenacious CIA intelligence officer, played by Claire Danes, recovering in a treatment center from suffering a mental breakdown during a 7-month stint in a Russian prison at the end of last season. Mathison is drafted back into action by longtime colleague Saul Berenson, played by Mandy Patinkin, now National Security Advisor to President Warner, played by Beau Bridges, to help close a peace agreement between the Afghan government and the Taliban. Naturally, the peace treaty doesn't go according to plan, and Mathison has to try to save the day and deal with colleagues suspicious that she might have betrayed her country while in prison. And given her fragmented memory, she's not entirely sure herself. I love the idea that Carrie is positioned as this suspected traitor, a Brody, Dane says, referring Damian Lewis's morally conflicted veteran from the show's early seasons. That's such a perfect parallel and fun to play. She's struggling from PTSD and doesn't know how to narrate her own story. Expect a grounded feeling season as the drama wrestles earnestly with the real-world complexities of having U.S. forces in the Middle East while also focusing on wrapping up Saul and Carrie's roller coaster relationship. Homeland was conceived as a story about a protege and a mentor. Showrunner Alex Gonza says the Saul-Carrie story has been the one constant through 8 seasons, and we really get to bring that story to a close. I hope we did it some justice. For Danes, the finale marks the end of a decade-long journey, and she says her last day of filming was a rough one. Things really come to a head with Saul, she says. It was very emotional, and I kind of lost it at the end. And this was reported by James Hibbert. We're going to finish up today's show with a few articles that we didn't read from the January issue of Entertainment Weekly. The first called The Lowdown. 40 years after he made his TV debut, Rob Lowe's career is still on fire. Here, the 55-year-old dishes on starring as a first responder on Fox's new drama, 911, Lone Star. It debuted January 19th at 10 p.m. This article is by Ruth Kenyanye. Some questions and answers. EW, what excited you about this series? Rob, the long story? Ryan Murphy wrote Nip Tuck for me, and my agents never gave it to me. How about them apples? He laughs. I had lunch with him and told him how much I loved Nip Tuck, and he was horrified as well that it didn't work out. It's one of the great Hollywood stories. For 15 years, we've been trying to find something to do together, but I've always been unavailable for the most part. I'm a big fan of what he, Brad Falchuk, and Tim Minear did with the genre. I love action. I love a good procedural. But that kind of special sauce they throw on it makes it not only really interesting to watch, but really, really interesting as an actor. In any given episode, I'm playing comedy, I'm playing leading man, I'm playing action, and I'm playing really raw emotion. You just don't get many opportunities as an actor to go to the kind of places that you can in Ryan, Tim, and Brad's shows. EW, tell us about your character, Owen, a New York firefighter who moves to Austin. Rob, Ryan's original pitch to me was he's an athletic, adventuresome, rugged, brave firefighter who cares very deeply about skin care. That was the pitch. Like I said, I've known Ryan forever, and Brad and I are very close friends. His wife, Gwyneth Paltrow, is the godmother to one of my sons, so they know me too well at this point. I will get entire scenes, and I'm just going, oh my God, he's just writing me. It's also this great dichotomy of a traditional action-oriented first responder character who also has a streak of larger-than-life narcissism about him. He fills a room and likes the spotlight, but he's very, very concerned with justice and people getting a fair shake. EW, Owen's putting together a new fire crew when he arrives in Austin. How important was it that the group was inclusive and represents all corners of society? Rob, anytime you can tell stories of people who are historically underrepresented is great for the culture. The notion of having a trans firefighter is a story you've never heard. We get to answer that in a really organic, non-woke police way. This is the 2020 iteration of a show like this. They were never going to do those stories on Emergency. EW, did you talk to firefighters to prepare for the role? Rob, unfortunately, California has had so many wildfires and floods, and my home area of Santa Barbara has really been through it. Through that, I've not only had so many firsthand experiences with losing people in my community, I've also become very, very close with the firefighters in that area, and I did some training down here with the LA Fire Department. I even hosted a bunch of them at my home during the fires. There's always somebody on set to tell you what equipment you would use and what you would wear. But for me, the most important thing is, what makes someone want to do that job? What do they love about it? What are the pitfalls? What are their fears? I'm lucky to have actual friends to rely on for that sort of stuff. EW, what's been the biggest challenge? Rob, there's an emotional side to playing Owen. My character is the only guy in his New York firehouse who survived 9/11. That informs every decision and how he views life. It's been very emotional and fraught, wanting to honor it in a way that doesn't feel like we're using it. Then the physicality of the role. I broke a rib last week, and this week I have to rescue someone who's drowning in a grain silo. There's no rest in sight. This is one of those shows that will kick your ass both mentally and physically. EW, does that go for the viewers as well? Rob, yes. You're going to go on a propulsive journey that is emotional as well as physical. You better fasten your seatbelts because it is coming at you. You premiere December 26th on Netflix. This time will be different, says Yu's charming bookworm and literal lady killer, Joe Goldberg, played by Penn Bagley, early on in season two. In some ways, he's right. The series has undergone a lot of changes. A new network, Netflix, a new locale, Los Angeles, a new leading lady, The Haunting of Hill House's Victoria Pedretti. But even so, the sexy, scary, funny, thrillist formula is starting to feel a little familiar. Having fled to L.A. to escape his vengeful ex, Candace, played by Amber Childers, Joe soon meets a beautiful chef named Love, played by Trip Pedretti. From there, the action, based on Hidden Bodies author Caroline Knepp's sequel to You, follows a blueprint viewers will recognize. Joe tracks Love's life from afar. He competes for his beloved's attention with her drug addict brother, 40, played by James Scully, and he finds himself looking out for a vulnerable teen, played by Jenna Ortega, who lives in his apartment complex. Much of the new season is fun. With two more books on the way, Netflix is unlikely to wrap up Joe's story with season two. The finale delivers a twist that lands somewhere between clever and too clever by half, and it sets up more story. You can't save someone from themselves, Joe tells us. Let's hope the same isn't true about you. This was recorded by Kristen Baldwin. And that takes us to the end of today's show of Entertainment Weekly Magazine for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you for tuning in. This has been your volunteer broadcaster, Lynn Wendling.